This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Police in Durham are searching for two missing people. One, a six-year-old boy named Jaden Higginbotham. Another, he has not been seen since October 6th. Another is 28-year-old Antoinetta McCoy, reported missing last month. Investigators believe their disappearances could be connected. Police say an informant told them that Jaden and Antoinetta were murdered by members of a religious sect called the Black Hebrews. And the informant, who was once in the group, says the Black Hebrews operate as a polygamous cult. So far, police say they have no material evidence to validate the informant's testimony, but characterizing the Black Hebrews as a cult could influence both the police investigation and news coverage of the cases. On today's show, we'll examine the culture of cults, what distinguishes them from well-established religions, social or political parties, and why public reaction to cult practices is often hostile. We're going to open the phones and take your calls if you have a question about this subject or if you have a story to share about being a member of a new religious movement or a closed community. We want to hear from you. If you'd like to talk about your personal perception of cults, give us a call at 877-962-9862. You can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. We will take your calls, but first I want you to meet Lisa Kerr. Lisa is the founder of the website mycultlife.com. where she recounts her experience as a member of the Master's Commission International Network. She spent 7 years with that group, which defines itself as an intense discipleship training program dedicated to making disciples of Christ. Lisa now defines it as a cult. Lisa Kerr, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
You were 17 years old. You were just out of high school when you decided to move to Phoenix, Arizona, and join the Master's Commission. How did you first find out about the group?
Yes, I was 17. I was actually attending high school, and they came to visit one of our local churches. From there, they actually came into our high school, and they did a, you know, drug-free, positive thinking assembly for us, and that's where I met some of these people.
So they were vetted in a way. I mean, your church thought they were okay to let in. Your school thought they were okay, right?
Oh yeah, they. The Master's Commission runs as a discipleship program, and then they have an entity called City Conquest. Some of the groups vary in names, but they go. Their purpose is to go into public schools and build relationships with young adults there.
And what attracted you to them?
Actually, two of the girls from that group stayed with us via our church, and so I got to know them personally. They seemed like really great people. They seemed very charismatic. Very happy, and I think that's a lot of what did it.
What kind of work were you looking to do as a Christian disciple?
When I first entered, I actually wanted to just solidify my relationship with God a little bit more, and then I wanted to go on to college. I'd always wanted to attend a university, probably since I was a little girl. So I think going into it, I didn't have any specific ministry goals or anything really associated with that group.
When you joined, tell us about that. What does membership mean? How were your first few days? And then what kind of work did you do?
Well, we entered and we had normal apartments, just like you would in college. But one of the first things we did was something called a covenant ceremony. And it's sort of a ritual where you give everything to God, including any previous ties to dating relationships, your family, anything else, and you spend time in prayer, and then someone preaches a sermon kind of geared towards unifying the group and kind of having you declare your loyalty to the group.
So you do that, and then are you assigned work responsibilities?
As a first-year student, your main goal is typically to study the Bible. You have an hour of prayer every morning, and then you are commissioned to work for the church for free. You're not getting paid for that. You can do anything from cleaning toilets to yard work in the church, building props that are going to be used in your next stage performance. They really vary.
And there was a lot of emphasis, you say, on appearance. What were you supposed to look like?
When I moved to Texas, that was my the second group that I attended, there was such a strict guideline for how a woman should look. She should wear lipstick. She should always have her hair done perfectly. She should be thin and fit. And the dress code was very, very strict. We had a dress code in Phoenix, but in Austin, Texas, it was enforced. So I came in not really knowing that the rules were so strict, and I had form-fitting jeans and maybe tight-fitting T-shirts, just like any normal 18, 19-year-old girl would have. And I was constantly told to go back to my room and change. Eventually, we had this experience where we had to burn everything that was too tight-fitting or was revealing.
The leader of the Masters Commission International Network is Lloyd Ziegler. Tell us about him.
I first met Lloyd when I lived in Phoenix, and he basically co-founded the group. The original founder has passed away. Lloyd was at Phoenix First Assembly of God, where the pastor is Tommy Barnett, very well known. And Lloyd is extremely charismatic person. You just fall in love with him when you meet him. You think that he's one of the most passionate, caring, compassionate people that you've ever met. He's since moved to the Dallas, Texas area, and he started Relevant Life Church, where they also have a Master's Commission there.
How big is Master's Commission? You've named three cities already.
Mm-hmm. It's actually an international group. I had gone on a missions trip to Myanmar, to Burma, in 1999. So there's a Master's Commission there in the Philippines, various countries, and all over the United States. There's even a group in North Carolina.
So it's a big group, international group. You stayed there 7 years.
Yes.
Now you describe it as a cult. What happened? How are you feeling? When did you decide that this was not quite right?
Sure. I think it was actually quite a process for me. Some of my friends from college in 2005, 2006, when I first entered, would continually tell me that the way I was getting treated, even after I left, very condescending people and all that, that it wasn't right. And it took me such a long time to break the relationships that I had with those people and the leadership there. But I think what really did it is a professor mentioned to me that I might try therapy. So I sat down with a counselor at the university there, and I described to her what happened, who I worked for, what I did, and she said, have you ever heard of a destructive group or a cult? And I said, yeah, of course. And she said, it really sounds to me like you were in a cult. And I couldn't believe it. So what she did is she went online there and she printed out some materials, what the definition of a cult was, the, destructive groups, how they pull people in. And I read it over and I started crying because that was exactly what I was in. So it was really a process for me.
You were in the group at the time.
Well, this was actually when I left. I left the group in 2005, and then I started attending university here in California.
Did you ever make an unsuccessful? Were you ever restricted? Did anybody try to keep you from leaving?
When I left, it was kind of, I basically had been sort of fed up with not being able to do anything, move on with my life. So I just told them I'm packing up and leaving. And I wasn't restricted, but they did tell me, oh, you'll be back, come back in a few years. And I was restricted while I was there. There was a huge element of controlling where we went and when we went there. We had to ask permission.
So you described when you discovered this idea that this had been a destructive group, that you were probably suffering from PTSD. What was good about it? What were the parts, and describe how you felt when it was working for you?
Well, I went in and was really excited. It was these people were performing in front of maybe 7,000 people, and they were just so energetic and lively, and they appeared to be this perfect model of what a Christian was and had it all together. They looked great. They had talent. They could dance, sing, all of these things that I wasn't. I was kind of a bookworm and studied a lot. So it really appealed to me in that way. And throughout my time there, I developed a lot of great friendships. And I think that's part of what kept me there was my peers were really great people. They had really good hearts and really wanted to do public service. And so I really connected with them. And I think that's a lot of what I took away from it as well.
You started a website, mycultlife.com. You have been critical of the group since. Have you received any backlash from the group? What's been the reaction?
When I first started it, I actually received calls from Lloyd Ziegler, the co-founder of the group. And he obviously wasn't happy. He told me on the phone that he was really hurt that I was using the word cult and Master's Commission together. And we talked for quite a few months, actually, where I expressed to him much of what I expressed in letters to him years before of the abuse that I faced. And I told him that it's just simply not acceptable. It's unethical for him to continue to let these things happen. And I have gotten a lot of backlash from people who are readers. They'll email me, comment to me, and they're obviously not very happy.
Talking with Lisa Kerr. She's the founder of the website, mycultlife.com. We're talking about cults today on The State of Things. Taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. If you've been a member of a closed society or a new religious organization, we'd like to hear from you if you want to talk about cults. Lisa's going to stay with us. We're also going to talk with some experts who've studied the way we look at cults, the way the media treats them, and the way we study, and when we use the word and when we don't. We'll talk about that today on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, we're exploring new religious movements. Sometimes we call them cults. And we're talking about the public perception of unconditional and unconventional spiritual practices. We've been talking with Lisa Kerr. She's the founder of the website MyCultLife.com. She was a member of a group called Master's Commission International Network. It is a very large network, a religious group. Joining us now is James Tabor. He's the chair of the Religious Studies Department at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Sean McLeod is an associate professor of religious studies at UNC Charlotte. Sean and James join us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hello, Frank. It's James.
James, good to have you on the program. Joining us now by phone is Benjamin Zeller. He's an assistant professor of religious studies at Brevard College in Brevard, North Carolina. Ben, welcome.
Thank you very much, Frank.
And again, we're taking your phone calls, 877-962-9862. We want to hear from you if you've had an experience, but also certainly join in the conversation as we continue. Sean, let me ask you a question and backtrack a little bit. We've used this word cult off and on. What kind of a definition should we be using to define cult? Sean?
Yeah, the term cult comes from cultus, originally meaning a ritual. So you could talk about the ancient Greco-Roman world, talk about something like the cult of Isis, meaning that it was a group that performed a specific ritual to a specific god or goddess. By the early 20th century, you have really different meanings of the term cult. Sociologists use that as an institutional term to discuss a group relatively new, that had a very lax amount of organization and institutionalization. Evangelical Protestants, starting in the early 20th century, used the term to mean any group that departs from evangelical Protestantism. So they would have included liberal Protestants, Roman Catholics, and world religions. But what we think of in popular terms today, cults, as in charges of brainwashing, coercion, deception, charlatanism, abuse, really doesn't appear until the 1970s in mainstream American media.
And what's happening there? Why is that occurring at that time? Why do we change our understanding?
A couple different reasons for it. And one is a grassroots anti-cult movement, as it came to be known, in which groups of parents that were unhappy having their children join certain religious movements at the time, whether they were some in cases of holiness Pentecostal groups, the International Society of Krishna Consciousness, the Unification Church, began to gather together to try to get their children, which I say children meaning young adults, college-age students, out of these groups. And they promoted the use of cult in that negative kind of way we use it today.
Well, let's go to the phones right now. We're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. And Preston's on the line from Durham. Hello, Preston.
Hello. How are you, Frank?
We're doing well. Yep. You have a question?
Yeah, for Ms. Kerr, as a parent and as someone who knows other parents whose children have fallen prey to these, what were her parents' involvement? What did they have to say about this organization coming to their school and her moving to Phoenix? And has she been in contact with them since? And how did she come to terms with the idea that she had to completely separate from her family?
Lisa?
Sure. I think that my parents were actually the most instrumental in helping remove me from that group. My parents were highly discouraged from visiting any time. We had some free time. We weren't really allowed to go home. So there was definitely an exclusion from your family. My parents did keep in touch with me, and they tried to visit me as much as possible, but we just didn't have time. So finally, my parents came to visit. They met the pastor that I was working for, and my dad just said, "I really don't like where you're at. I don't like how they're treating you, and I think you need to leave." So those were the terms that I decided to leave.
James Tabor, this word, and thank you for your call, Preston. James Tabor, this word cult, you can see, as Sean suggests, it changes its meaning as we become more concerned about danger associated with fringe groups that are not in the mainstream. Is it a word that we should be careful of? Should we be careful how we use it?
I don't worry about Lisa using it because I think it's totally understandable. And I think from hearing her testimony, we're all glad that she's enjoying a free and healthy life. And she sounds very, as some people would say, recovered from that experience. But what I really worry about is the government or the media, because if you have a religion that's high demand, it's new, it's not well known, a very strong charismatic leader, and then the media or the news organizations or even the society as a whole says, well, that's a cult. You have to question who's passing out the labels. Mm. I know when Waco took place, it was the day of the fire, President Clinton held a press conference in the White House garden, and he said something about how sad he was about the fire and so forth. But he said, after all, it was a cult. Mm. And I think that sort of labeling is of the word. It becomes a sort of a pejorative term. And I'm concerned with who passes it out, who decides. Because in the United States, in a free society, in any democracy, we don't really have approved and disapproved religions, officially speaking. And it's really less left up to us as individuals, as educators, as parents, to debate and to talk with one another about our religious convictions. But the labels bother me because I think sometimes labels can kill. They can cause reactions the part of governmental authorities.
Benjamin Zeller.
That would be my.
Yeah, and so it really raises that question. When do we impose the word? Certainly one of the defining characteristics of those organizations that get called cult is that they're somehow outside of the mainstream, however we define that, and tend to be small. Benjamin Zeller, I know you've spent time, you've embedded yourself with groups that are outside the mainstream. What have you found when you get there? Are there any links, any ways to describe those groups, characteristics they have in common?
I think it's important to note from the beginning that the people who join these groups are normal people, as normal as all the rest of us are, in that the sort of issues they're dealing with in their lives are the same sort of issues that we all deal with. When I spent some time studying a community associated with the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, or the Hare Krishnas, which were in the 70s considered one of the paragons of being a cult or a new religious movement, as we call them, I found that the people I talked to were concerned about things like their jobs, raising their families, how they're going to pay for repair of their temple. I mean, it's the same sort of stuff that most people deal with in their personal and religious lives. What all new religious movements have in common, and if you want to use the word cult, that's I don't use that word, but new religious movements would be relatively synonymous, is that they're new and outside the mainstream, or at least they look new to us. And therefore, they're They're frightening to many people, and they're threatening as well in many ways. They're threatening because they challenge the norms of our society. They say things like, drop out of college and don't try to make a lot of money. Come join our group and focus just on God. They say things like, don't dress in clothing, which normal Americans do. Don't eat the normal food that normal Americans do. And this can be threatening to our culture.
And let's see how those kinds of groups are covered and labeled. We opened this program with a local story about a pair of missing people who may have ties to a religious sect called the Black Hebrews. And let's review the basic facts with a clip from ABC News coverage of the case.
Two missing people and two possible murders. Durham police continue to search for 5-year-old Jaden Higginbotham and Antoinetta McCoy, a woman who lived here in this Durham home with the boy, his mother, and several other women. According to our sources and court documents, all of them were under the command of this man, Peter Moses, the leader of a so-called black cult. Eyewitness News spoke to McCoy's sister by phone.
She was like, you don't understand about how it works, is that like they kill people, and that he was known for carrying guns, and everybody down there that affiliated with him was afraid of him.
So here we have news coverage. The reporter wrapped the phrase cult in quotes, so-called, but Sean, could the use of the word cult in news coverage of a criminal case have influence on the way police investigate, do you think?
Absolutely. And the story that you just played for us reminded me of a Leo Pfeffer study that he did in the 1980s. He had 300 college students of his. He's a psychologist. And he had them all read the exact same story about a gentleman who joins a group that requires him to dress certain ways, eat certain things, pray at certain times of day, do other sorts of activities. And he changed the name of the group. It was called a cult, it was called the army, and it was called a Roman Catholic seminary. Even though it was the exact same story, when it was called a cult, it was widely seen as negative. When it was called a Roman Catholic seminary, it was more positive, and then people were mixed when it was called the army. But again, the story was exactly the same.
So it's going to have an influence, and we'll talk a little bit later in the program, too, on law enforcement. We'll take a look at Waco and again, how public perceptions led to the deaths of 80 members of the Branch Davidians, four federal agents. First, I want to go to the phones, where Shirley is on the line from Apex. Hello, Shirley.
Hi, how you doing?
We're doing fine. How about you?
I'm doing great.
Good. You have a question for us or a story for us?
I have a comment. My husband and I were in a cult, the Way Ministry, in the early 80s. And they were primarily, of course, after money. And they would have all kinds of classes for you to take. And I was in there for 3 years. And I finally got out because I had paid for a class that they wanted me to take. But I was working in Virginia at the time. And they wanted me to stop taking care of this precious woman that I was looking after. And they got mad at me because I wouldn't drop everything and take this class. So I told them that it's more Christian to take care of this woman that I was taking care of than to stop taking care of her and to take a class. And they did not appreciate that. So I just told them, that's it. I don't want to have anything more to do with you.
When you joined the organization, did you consider it a cult? Were your friends warning you that it was a cult? Were they using that kind of language?
Oh, they were calling themselves a cult.
Oh, all right. And that, yeah. And that didn't put you off, the idea that it was...
Well, not at the time, no, because they were very friendly to me. They accepted me with all my challenges with being extremely shy at the time. And it just seemed like a very nice organization to be around because they were in the Bible. But they were adding things to it, like it's okay to sin because we're under the grace of God. And that just seemed rather odd to me when I started realizing that they're telling me it's okay to do whatever I want if I want to go out and get drunk or high.
Mm. Well, you left the group, and Shirley, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you for having me on.
877-962-9862. Lisa, were you able to have conversations like that? It sounds like Shirley began to have doubts and voice them within the group. She got some pushback, but at least she felt like she could talk about them within the group. Did you feel that way?
It was actually really interesting. In our group, we were discouraged from talking to one another about things that we didn't like. I had a really good friend in the group. I'm still friends with her now. And we would kind of go down the hallway from our dorms, and we would just sort of make fun of the absurdities that happened that we didn't agree with. And occasionally some staff members would come find us and reprimand us and, you know, ask us what we were talking about. So really, if we disagreed, it was completely shut down. We were taught to obey authority, to be loyal to them, and to be teachable.
And at the time, of course, this all made sense to you. This is a new organization?
Well, at the time, some of it made sense and some of it was uncomfortable, but I had a leader who was very militaristic, and he would pull us aside and he would do one-on-one meetings that we would – it wasn't exactly yelling, but he was just really, really stern with us about what he disagreed with, whether it was a shirt that I wore or if I liked some other guy, some guy in the group. We would have these sessions where we would just be told to basically do exactly what he told or get kicked out.
Do you feel now that this is a group that should be investigated, or just people ought to be careful when they make their choice about going in and getting out?
I think they should be investigated because there are a lot of labor laws that exist that I didn't really look into at the time that they're breaking. There's some people who are going in from, maybe they were homeschooled and they're 16 years old, and they're going into basically what I consider slave labor for the church or for the director.
Sean McLeod, in your first book, Making the American Religious Fringe, Exotics, Subversives, and Journalists, you looked at how outside spiritual communities were represented in mainstream magazines after World War II. And, of course, the coverage is going to dictate a lot of how the law enforcement is going to work. Did something change in the reporting on new religious movements in the post-war era?
There were quite a bit of changes, and for the kind of discussion we're having today, really the point in which this dramatic change occurs is the mid-1970s, and then especially the late 1970s, and it's because of a couple events. Some trials going on in the mid-1970s in which parents paid money to people like Ted Patrick to kidnap their children out of some new religious movements, and these things went to trial. And then, of course, on November 18th, 1978, there was the mass suicide of the People's Temple at Jonestown in Guyana. And the coverage of that, as one scholar, Eileen Barker, said, kind of solidified that cult image we have that we still see in mass media today.
James, you are the author of a number of books, including Why Waco, Cults and the Battle for Religious Freedom. You're a Texas native, and you, of course, witnessed the tragedy of the Branch Davidian compound. First, remind us briefly of that story and how it ended.
Well, it was 1993. I have to remind myself that my students weren't born then. So, as I'm teaching them, they have heard of Waco, though. The image they have is the day of the fire, you know, just that we all have, those of us who experienced it, kind of the magazine cover image of the fire. But what happened was a government agency, BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, did a raid on what they called a religious compound. And one of the things that you see over and over again is the group uses one term. They would say our home. They did a raid on our home where we live communally, and the government would say the compound. And reason for the raid was the possibility of certain illegal weapons. And then it escalated. Gunfire broke out, lots of disputes about who shot first and so forth, but four federal agents were killed. FBI came in. There was a 51-day siege. And it ended with this fire, and I think there's still a dispute as to how this fire started, accidentally, on purpose. Did the government start it, which I certainly don't believe, by the way. But the aftermath was that all these people were dead. And the question was, why did it happen in the first place? And I think part of the reason it happened was because what Sean just said about Jonestown, this is another cult. David Koresh is the name of the leader, who's now dead. He died in the fire. Is a manipulating, sexually immoral, abusing person. And yet when you interview the members, they all tell different stories. And as Ben said, you know, they also sound very intelligent and they don't look brainwashed at all. And they give articulate, they sound a lot like Lisa, whether they're in or out, just giving a straightforward, rational story about how they got attracted to the group, why it satisfied their religious needs and so forth. So it was terrible, and I and another colleague had negotiated with the lawyers a surrender plan that we think would have worked, but unfortunately it didn't get communicated properly at the higher levels, and so we had this final day when the fire broke out.
Tell you what, I want to take a break right here, come back and find out what that plan was and what actually happened, and continue our conversation about the culture of cults on the state of things today. Lisa Kerr, founder of the website MyCultLife.com. James Tabor, chair of the Religious Studies Department at UNC Charlotte. Sean McLeod, associate professor of religious studies at UNC Charlotte as well. Benjamin Zeller, assistant professor of religious studies, Brevard College. And your calls at 877-962-9862. When we return on The State of Things, stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're considering the culture of cults today on the program. Lisa Kerr is one of my guests, founder of the website MyCultLife.com. James Tabor, chair of the Religious Studies Department at UNC Charlotte, also the author of a number of books, including Why Waco, Cults and the Battle for Religious Freedom in America. Sean McLeod is an associate professor of religious studies at UNC Charlotte. Sean's the author of Making the American Religious Fringe, Exotics, Subversives, and Journalists, 1955-93. And Benjamin Zeller is an assistant professor of religious studies at Brevard College. His book is called Prophets and Protons. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. James Tabor, before the break, we were talking about the Branch Davidians, the tragedy at Waco. And you said that there was a plan that you and another had suggested, but that one never got off the ground. What do you think might have worked?
Well, once people were killed and you had the siege, what I felt, and Dr. Philip Arnold, working with the lawyer Dick DeGuerin, who was going in talking to Koresh on a daily basis about a week before the fire, you have to appeal to the worldview of the group and to David Koresh particularly. And so what we tried to do was to offer him a kind of a surrender plan where his people could all come out safely, and then there would be a trial to decide the legalities of what actually happened. And he finally went for that. But the tactical people were convinced that it was just another ploy. And Janet Reno was not told of the surrender plan. And so she finally approved the tank siege with the gas. And what you don't do to a group like Koresh is attack them, because then you confirm every single stereotype they have of the government. Because he was calling the government Babylon, and then Babylon attacks you with tanks shooting gas into this flimsy building, and they had their Armageddon. And so there's a sense in which our government delivered them the Armageddon that they thought would someday come, and it was very unfortunate. What you want to do is diffuse the situation, almost make it boring. Apocalypticism thrives on excitement, on something happening. And when nothing happens, and I, 51 days of a siege, it's not as though nothing happened. They were constantly playing loud music, playing screams of animals being killed, turning off the lights, basically torturing these people, thinking they'll come out, we'll force them out. And it only reinforced them. And so my sense of Waco, or really any group, is that our only refuge is the power of persuasion that we all have individually, with my students, with parents with their children, and all of us with our friends, to honestly communicate what we see or what we believe about religion and its potential destructiveness, if we see that. But basically, even more than that, are laws. And if laws are broken, that's the refuge, and people have to be dealt with. But really, you can't arrest people for thinking things, even if you think that the things they think are absolutely delusional and ridiculous and even do harm to people under their influence. It's like, think of a couple madly in love and you feel that one or the other is just really ruining their life in sacrifice to an abusive relationship. But we can't, you know, this happens all the time, and the way we deal with it is not to bring the law in or the government, but to try to work with people.
Well, and in different ways, we bring the law in different ways. I mean, even if you think you've got an armory there and those guns are illegal, Ben Zeller, do you think it's true that once a group is labeled a cult with all of the, in the way that James Tabor has described, these kind of other ways of thinking, that that law enforcement treats it as a different situation and is perhaps more likely to use violence and force?
Absolutely, because one of the assumptions we all have about cults is that the members aren't adherents, they're victims. So therefore, instead of treating them as rational people that you can reason with, that you can talk to, we assume that either they're duped victims who've been brainwashed, or they're collaborators with the evil leaders. And that's the assumptions which we make when we use a term like cult. And that can really get in the way of, as James Tabor was explaining, a rational negotiation and an attempt to defuse situations like this.
Let's go to the phones. David is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, David.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing just fine.
Good.
I heard with interest a lady called in a little while ago that said that she had been a member of The Way, which she called a cult. I personally have been affiliated with The Way for quite some time. Over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was, in one sense, actually a little bit amused by her comment.
You would not call it a cult, are you saying?
Sometimes I think when people label our organization a cult, sometimes I get a little irritated, and sometimes I actually think it's kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who attends a fellowship is welcome to come or welcome to leave however they please. They don't even have membership. You can't join The Way. It's a free, open fellowship. And if somebody wants to learn whatever we have to offer, come on. If you don't, okay.
Well, David, I appreciate your call. And Sean McLeod, I think that gets at something you were saying right at the very beginning of the program. Who has the right to brand the group?
Yeah, and you know, I think one of my favorite definitions of cult comes from another religion scholar, Robert Elwood. And what he said essentially is cult most often is a term that refers to a group in which the speaker doesn't like. More than it has anything specific to do with a discrete set of characteristics shared by a religious movement or a set of religious movements.
James Tabor, I know you have written about the birth of Christianity. You've written about Paul of Tarsus, who in many ways assembled and organized what is now Christianity. I mean, there was a time when Christianity was considered a cult, and there were a number of Jesus followers, many of whom today are still Jewish and in some cases still considered a cult.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because if you think about Jesus, and I specialize in, you know, the search for the historical Jesus, what he was really about. And the one thing he was very high demand. And even though his high demand sayings as a leader are not popularly thought of as cult sayings, you think of the man who said, I need to bury my father and mother, and then I'll follow you. And Jesus says, let the dead bury the dead. Another person says, I've got to go tell my parents goodbye. And he said, nobody comes to me who does not hate his father, mother, wife, children. That sort of language used today by anybody in one of these groups would be just almost outlawed. It would be horrific. But because it's on the mouth of Jesus, whom everybody reveres, it's understood as, well, it was meant spiritually. But apparently, as we can trace things in what we call the Jesus movement, people did leave their families and their goods and give over everything to the movement. And some of these groups, like the one Lisa was part of, in my opinion, unfortunately, they try to mimic that today. And one of the powers they have is to say we're following Jesus, and that organized Christianity is weak and demands nothing of people, and it's just a social club. If you really want to follow Christ, you've got to respond to these demands. So you see the kind of thing that was going on. And as you said, the Romans are watching from the sidelines and using the word cult, or even more than cult, illegal religion, that this is not an approved, bona fide religion. And fortunately, in the United States, we don't have approved and disapproved religions, and so we're left to our public discourse. And I think most of us are thankful for that. It's the price of freedom, and it's a heavy price, but we pay it in all areas of life where there are sharp differences between us.
To Sean McLeod, we don't have approved or disapproved official religions, but we do have ways of sanctioning and approving others. To what extent does a group's anti-authoritarian or just differences in and perhaps threats to the mainstream culture risk that this group is going to be labeled a cult or on the outside?
Yeah, and it really depends upon the time period. I mean, it's interesting if you think about how we're talking about the term cult today. If this had been the late 1950s or early 1960s, coverage of groups that today would be called cults and then were called cults were comical. So California New Religious Movements Are Funny, Life magazine says, Look magazine says. At the same time, in that same time period of coverage, you have coverage of the Nation of Islam as a subversive, possibly communist movement who's very dangerous. So at different times, you see these labels being applied to different religious groups. But I think the most dangerous thing of this is when you try to describe what are, no exaggeration, literally thousands of different religious movements, many of them fairly new religious movements, all under one label as cult, because it implies that they have something in common that, for the most part, they probably don't.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Mike is on the line from Reidsville. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. The reason I'm calling is, gentlemen, I bow to your wisdom, and with no disrespect intended, I think probably we might have missed the target on this. It seems to me that when you discuss the term cult, what you're really discussing is a control, or a whether it be voluntary or involuntary, control over the thought process and the actions of the people that are involved in it. As, for instance, Ms. Carla's concerned, I'm sure she didn't think at the time she was involved with her organization that what she was doing was considered to be bad for her. She was probably very happy with it. And to use the term religion, that, I mean, that, it seems to me that that's merely a method of control. And I use that term because being involved in Amway for over 19 years and leaving about 9 or 10 years ago, I remember when I left the Amway business, there was a tremendous degree of post-stress syndrome involved in that. Because there, even today, I still think about rejoining, re-upping, and getting back involved in that that stigma, that a positive influence aspect. But it had virtually nothing to do with religion. It was all about what you can and can't do, and just making sure that you did what was good for the business, so to speak, as opposed to what was good for the individual.
Well, Mike, I think you're raising a good question, one I want to put to Lisa, and thank you for your call. And that's this idea that whenever we condition ourselves to any kind of a job, I mean, can you imagine if people came out of some jobs and actually got tested for PTSD, how many people would just having acculturated to a job that was, you know, not for them leads to that. Lisa, did you at any time, and do you think now that there was, that you had ever lost control of your thought process, that someone else was in control?
Yes, absolutely. I think he brings up a good point because all of these militaristic aspects were geared towards one thing, to secure your loyalty, to convince you that you were an elite Christian, and to put distrust towards your family. So everyone you originally trusted that could give you advice was all of a sudden closed down, and you were supposed to be loyal to these people. We had forced public confessionals. We were discouraged from TV, internet, movies, etc. So pretty soon, when your only influence is their voices, you start to give way.
Sean McLeod, you know, this raises questions, though, about the institutions that we revere and need in this society. The military works on precisely those principles. You have to be loyal to your commander and to your troops and not to anybody else. That's how this works. And there are those who argue that women today, minorities today, are in the position they are because of a systematic, if not intentional, effort to keep them in subservient positions.
No, that's a great point, Mike, and I think both, I'm sorry, Frank, mm-hmm. and both Mike and Lisa's stories really do point to something that is serious out here, and that's that in various social relationships and various institutional relationships, there are certain amounts of coercion, persuasion, of socialization, and some of those can be unhealthy and extreme. I think that, though, is a completely separable discussion than having to label or name something a cult. Because, as you note, if a cult is a religious group that seems extra coercive and persuasive, how do we weigh something like the military? How do we weigh the so-called mainstream religious groups that require a certain amount of adherence? What do we think of monks, for example? There are just no easy lines to draw on this.
And James Tabor, the other fact is that certainly bad things happen. There are, in some of the news stories that we're talking about, awful things happen. But there are laws against those things, and there are law enforcement techniques designed to bring the lawbreakers to court and bring them through due process.
Yeah, I think it's really our only recourse if we want a free society with free thought. And then we all need to watch out for one another and to care about the people we love. And I think none of us ourselves want to be in a coercive social situation, whether it's religion, whether it's what Mike mentioned, some sort of Amway-type operation. I've never been in Amway, but I've heard stories. Or even a love relationship or a family situation that's abusive and coercive. But I really think our recourse has to be the rule of law, and then for us all to watch out for one another. But religion can, I wanted to pick up on Sean's thing, think not to pick on a church, but think of the history of Christianity, the long history of Christianity, and some of the most horrible things that have been done by perfectly acceptable mainstream groups in terms of murder, killing, torture, and so forth. And yet, you know, today, what would we say? We'd say, well, if any of those... you think of the scandal in the Roman Catholic Church now. If any of those groups break the law, then we have recourse. And that's what's going on now with some of the sexual abuse cases.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. James Tabor, chair of the Religious Studies Department at UNC Charlotte, author of Why Waco, Cults and the Battle for Religious Freedom in America. Sean McLeod, associate professor of religious studies, UNC Charlotte, author of Making the American Religious Fringe, Exotic Subversives and Journalists, 1955-93. Benjamin Zeller, assistant professor of religious studies at Brevard College. His book is called Prophets and Protons. And Lisa Kerr is founder of the website MyCultLife.com. Thank all of you for being on the program. Thank you for listening and calling. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.